very relevant to what goes on today.
That's Ilan Pape, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ilan Pape on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel claims that there is no need for explanations as to why Hamas attacked on October 7, 2023. Historian Ilan Pape challenges that point of view. He says that without historical contextualization, the issues are not only incomprehensible, but also make people vulnerable to half-truths and propaganda. For decades, corporate media coverage of the conflict has been lopsided in Israel's favor. Israelis are humanized, Palestinians are demonized. Ilan Pape points out that the Israel-Palestine conflict didn't start on October 7th, nor did it start with the 1917 Balfour Declaration or with 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights, or in 1948, when the State of Israel was declared. Roots of the conflict began in 1882, when the first Zionist settlers arrived in what was then Turkish-controlled Palestine. Our guest today is Ilan Pape. He's been called Israel's bravest historian. He taught at the University of Haifa. Currently, he's professor of history.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Republicans should say, we want to take over. We should take over the voting in at least many, 15 places. The Republicans ought to nationalize the voting.
President Trump's calling for elections to be nationalized in his latest bid to keep Republicans in power. This comes after the FBI raided an election facility in Fulton County, Georgia, to seize ballots from the 2020 election, which Trump falsely claims he won. We'll speak with Arizona's Secretary of State and with a former Department of Justice voting official. Then arms control groups are warning the world is moving closer to nuclear war as the U.S. threatens to attack Iran and a major U.S.-Russian nuclear treaty known as New START expires Thursday.
For the first time in over half a century, there will be nothing preventing a runaway nuclear arms race.
Then we look at the White House meeting between President Trump and Colombian President Gustavo Petro. In recent weeks, Trump had repeatedly threatened to attack Colombia, but Trump struck a very different tone on Tuesday. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump doubled down on his calls for the Republican Party to nationalize voting in the United States, even as the White House tried to walk back his comments. Republican lawmakers also criticized the idea, with Senate Majority Leader John Thune saying, quote, "It's harder to hack 50 election systems than it is to hack one." Speaking to reporters yesterday in the Oval Office, President Trump repeated false claims about the 2020 election and urged the federal government to take over voting in the United States.
If a state can't run an election, I think the people behind me should do something about it. Because, you know, if you think about it, a state is an agent for the federal government in elections. I don't know why the federal government doesn't do them anyway.
Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution designates individual state legislatures with determining how elections are held. Meanwhile, House Republicans unveiled the Make Elections Great Again Act, calling for voters to present a photo ID and verify their citizenship when registering to vote. It comes as officials in Fulton County, Georgia, promised to take legal action after the FBI last week seized truckloads of ballots and documents, 700 boxes from the 2020 election. National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard defended her presence at the FBI raid at the Fulton County Election Center, telling Democratic lawmakers she was there to identify possible foreign interference. Gabbard is also facing renewed backlash following reports by the Wall Street Journal that she's allegedly hiding a whistleblower complaint accusing her of wrongdoing. The Journal reported the whistleblower's complaint is so highly classified that it's, quote, said to be locked in a safe, unquote, and it has not been shared with Congress. The whistleblower's lawyer has also accused Gabbard of stonewalling the complaint, which was filed last May. Speaking on Capitol Hill, the brothers of Rene Good urged Congress to restrain President Trump's crackdown on immigration. Brent and Luke Ganger testified at a hearing held by congressional Democrats on Tuesday on the violent use of force by federal immigration agents deployed to cities across the U.S. Brent Ganger read from his eulogy to his sister, saying Good was, quote, unapologetically hopeful. And this is Luke Ganger. He calls his sister Nay, addressing lawmakers on Tuesday.
The completely surreal scenes taking place on the streets of Minneapolis are beyond explanation. This is not just a bad day or a rough week or isolated incidents. These encounters with federal agents are changing the community and changing many lives, including ours, forever.
Not a single Republican lawmaker showed up for the hearing. Among others who testified at the forum Tuesday were Aaliyah Rahman, who was violently dragged out of her car by federal immigration officers in Minneapolis, Martin Daniel Ruskin, who was shot by border agents in California while driving his family, and Marimar Martinez, who was shot five times by a federal immigration agent in Chicago last year. This is Martinez.
At the hospital, I remember seeing multiple agents standing around, watching me be treated for my wounds. My arms, legs, and chest were all wrapped in bandages. I had 7 bullet holes in my body.
Democratic Congressmember Robert Garcia then displayed text by the Border Patrol agent after he shot Martinez.
The agent linked an article about your shooting and...
New York Attorney General Letitia James announced Tuesday she'll be deploying legal observers to document federal immigration raids across New York. The move comes as federal immigration agents face mounting scrutiny over excessive use of force in the aftermath of at least 4 fatal shootings since September. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, several people were detained by ICE in Jersey City and Hoboken over the weekend. A video recorded by Jersey City Council member Jake Efros during the arrests has getting that in your head. That's it, unquote. President Trump signed the consolidated funding bill hours after it passed the House, ending the partial government shutdown for now. The legislation includes only a 2-week extension of funding for the Department of Homeland Security. Democratic lawmakers are calling for reforms on federal immigration enforcement as part of a deal to negotiate more funding for DHS. In a state,
more funding for DHS.
With respect to the Department of Homeland Security funding bill next week, Jeffrey said. Colombian President Gustavo Petro sat down with Trump in a closed-door meeting that lasted approximately 2 hours at the White House Tuesday. It was the first face-to-face encounter between the two leaders following months of tension and heated exchanges over the Trump administration's military strikes on civilian boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific Ocean. Their talks also came a month after the U.S. attack on Venezuela and the abduction of Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro and his wife in early January. After the White House meeting, Petro shared a photo on social media with a note apparently handwritten by Trump that said, quote, "Gustavo, a great honor. I love Colombia," unquote, with a photograph of the two leaders shaking hands and smiling. Trump took on a drastically different tone after he previously insulted Petro and falsely accused him of being a drug trafficker, threatening Colombia with U.S. military action. Petro spoke after the meeting yesterday.
I told him that between free people, one cannot act under blackmail. Do this or else this happens. No. We do not act under blackmail. And I think the photos and the atmosphere of the meeting show a meeting between equals who think differently. Yes, with different powers, obviously, but capable of finding common paths. That's it. Nothing personal. He did not speak to me about his businesses, nor I about mine, which I do not have.
Colombian President Petro traveled to Washington, D.C. on a special visa after the Trump administration revoked his previous one in September when Petro joined a pro-Palestine rally outside the United Nations headquarters in New York and urged U.S. soldiers to disobey Trump. The Trump administration also issued sanctions against Petro and his family in October. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. The U.S. military announced it shot down an Iranian drone that approached its aircraft carrier in the Arabian Sea. It comes as President Trump confirmed the U.S. is currently negotiating with Iran over its nuclear program. Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, are expected to meet with the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, in Istanbul on Friday. We'll have more on this story and the bulletin of concerned scientists saying that the doomsday clock is closer to zero than it's ever been, closer to midnight than it's ever been in history. Israeli airstrikes killed at least 20 Palestinians, including children, across Gaza today. Israel's killed over 500 Palestinians since the U.S. brokered so-called ceasefire went into effect in October. It comes as the Palestinian Red Crescent says the evacuation of patients and wounded Palestinians via the southern Rafah crossing has been canceled for today. Israel's been tightly controlling the Rafah crossing since it partially reopened Monday after 2 years of total closure. On Tuesday, only five medical evacuees were allowed to leave and only 12 Palestinians were allowed to re-enter Gaza from Egypt. 56-year-old Huda Abu Abed was among the few people let back into Gaza after Israel's delayed reopening of the Rafah crossing under last year's ceasefire.
They said the crossing was going to open. You know how long we've been waiting for the crossing to open? Because no matter what, there is nothing like your homeland. It is right there. Everything needed for life is available. Everything is there. But our longing for our country, we can't be distant from it or give it up.
Meanwhile, two Human Rights Watch employees have resigned after HRW's leadership blocked a report which called Israel's denial of the right of return for Palestinians a crime against humanity. Omar Shakir, who led the Israel and Palestine team, said in his resignation letter, quote, "The one topic, even at Human Rights Watch, for which there remains an unwillingness to apply the law and the facts in a principled way, is the plight of refugees and their right to return to the homes that they were forced to flee," unquote. To see our interviews with Omar Shakir, you can go to democracynow.org. Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office yesterday, President Trump insulted CNN reporter Caitlin Collins for not smiling as she asked him about Epstein survivors.
What would you say to the survivors who feel like they haven't gotten justice?
You are the worst reporter. No wonder CNN has no ratings because of people like you. You know, she's a young woman. I don't think I've ever seen you smile. I've known you for 10 years. I don't think I've ever seen a smile
in
your
face. I'm asking you about survivors.
You know why you're not smiling? Because you know you're not telling the truth. And you're a very dishonest organization. And they should be ashamed of you.
These are survivors of a sexual abuse or health care.
Recently, President Trump called CBS's Nancy Cordes stupid, Katie Rogers from the New York Times ugly. And when Catherine Lucy of Bloomberg News asked him about releasing the Epstein files, Trump told her, quiet, piggy. And hundreds of workers at Hearst Magazine staged a half-day walkout in New York City to call for a fair contract, protections against AI, better wages, and work flexibility. This comes as management failed to reach an agreement with the union after their contract expired last month. This is Mary Fama, an art director at Cosmopolitan Magazine, Cosmo, speaking to Democracy Now!
AI is going to be a problem for writers, for creatives, for a long time. And these are the things that are, you know, we're worried about in the future. So we want these AI protections now to keep us, you know, safe and know that our work is respected here.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump doubled down on his calls to nationalize elections in the United States as he continues to falsely claim he won the 2020 election over President Biden. On Monday, Trump appeared on a podcast hosted by Dan Bongino, who recently resigned as FBI deputy director.
Say, we want to take over. We should take over the voting in at least many, 15 places. The Republicans ought to nationalize the voting.
Under the Constitution, U.S. elections are governed by states and administered by county and municipal officials in thousands of precincts. Trump was asked about his call to nationalize elections Tuesday.
What exactly did you mean when you said that you should nationalize elections? And which 15 states are you talking about?
I want to see elections be honest. And if a state can't run an election, I think the people behind me should do something about it. Because, you know, if you think about it, a state is an agent for the federal government in elections. I don't know why the federal government doesn't do them anyway. But when you see some of these states about how horribly they run their elections, what a disgrace it is, I think the federal government, when you see crooked elections, and we had plenty of them, and by the way, we had them last time, but go to 2020 and look at the facts that are coming out, rigged, crooked elections. If we have areas, take a look at Detroit, take a look at Pennsylvania, take a look at Philadelphia, you go take a look at Atlanta, look at some of the places that horrible corruption on elections, and the federal government should not allow that. The federal government should get involved. These are agents of the federal government to count the votes. If they can't count the votes legally and honestly, then somebody else should take
over. The Constitution says that should be states that administer elections.
Trump's remarks come days after the FBI raided an election facility in Fulton County, Georgia, and seized truckloads of ballots and documents, something like 700 boxes from the 2020 election. U.S. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard was present at the raid and later used her cell phone to let President Trump speak to the FBI agents, a move that has alarmed former Justice Department officials. This all comes as Republicans continue to face major electoral losses. On Tuesday, Democrat Taylor Rennett won a Texas state Senate seat, receiving 57% of the vote in a district that Trump had won by 17 percentage points in 2024. Trump has publicly expressed fear he'll be impeached again if Democrats win back control of the House in November. To look more at President Trump's attacks on the nation's voting system, we go to Phoenix, Arizona, where we're joined by Adrian Fontes, Arizona's Secretary of State. He's the former county recorder for Maricopa County, Arizona. He oversaw the elections there in 2020. The Justice Department has sued Arizona and over 20 other states for their full voter registration lists. Secretary Adrian Fontes, thanks so much for joining us. If you can start off by just responding to President Trump saying he wants to federalize, to nationalize the elections, and what exactly that means.
Well, what it means is that you, as an American, if you are comfortable right now in the face of this rhetoric, then you are with the regime. It's really that simple. This is the moment where the American public should be exercising its power under the First Amendment to stand and be counted. What we have right now is sort of a welcome to the third world doormat, and we're walking right over it as if nothing is going on. And so very clearly, my call is not what my reaction is. It ought to be what your reaction is as an American. Again, if you're comfortable, you're with the White House.
So talk about what it means that Arizona has refused to hand over the voter rolls. It's very interesting. I was just watching Minnesota Governor Walz, who, you know, was responding to Pam Bondi saying maybe they would pull out, you know, end the surge if Minnesota would give over the voter rolls. I want to go right now to Governor Walz.
Look, I think everybody understands what the last request was, totally unrelated to anything on the voter files. This is, again, as the Attorney General said, Donald Trump telling everybody that the election was rigged, who started all this nightmare for America, has nothing to do with it.
So he believes that ultimately this isn't even about immigration, what's happening in Minnesota and the killing of two U.S. citizens there by immigration agents, that this is about getting control of the voter rolls. I mean, Pam Bondi specifically said she wants those voter rolls. A number of states, what, about a dozen, have said they'll hand them over. But Arizona, your state, Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, says no. What does that mean?
Well, no means no. And what's happening in Wisconsin with that extortion letter will take our gang off the streets if you hand us, you know, this thing that we value. Speaks again to what I said earlier. Look, if they were comfortable with their policies and they were excited about facing the public, they would love to have an election. They would love to have the states just running things the way they did. And the clip earlier where Donald Trump said, oh, 2020 was corrupt, but 2024 was okay. You know, it just speaks to the notion that he understands very, very clearly that there are consequences to leadership when facing the power of the American people. And that power regularly gets exercised through the normal process of elections. Elections are the predictable, normal, I've likened them to a golden thread that run through the fabric of our society. It binds everything together. And what he's trying to do is pull that golden thread out and disintegrate the entire fabric of our society and throw us into chaos, unpredictability. And that's bad for business. It's bad for science. It's bad for the arts. It's bad for innovation. It's bad for, you know, entrepreneurs. It's bad for everyone. This is a moment right now when, like here in Arizona, we should not be handing over any of our personal identifying information to the president. Not only should we not be doing it, but it's against the law for me to fulfill the request from the Department of Justice. But let me make one thing very, very clear here as well. The Department of Justice has never asked the state of Arizona, through my office or any other means that I'm aware of, for the regularly available voter list that is available through a public records request. Well, what they've asked for is all of the personal identifying information that we are charged by law to keep confidential under penalty of felony conviction. Huh. Okay, we're talking about mother's last names, date and month of birth, part or whole of your social security number, tribal ID numbers. These are the things that we are charged to keep confidential, and the Department of Justice is asking for it, and I'm just saying no. So to your question, what does no mean? No means no.
You oversaw the 2020 election in Maricopa County, another extremely important county, and, you know, another very, very important county in voting. in national elections, also targeted by a conspiracy and misinformation campaign to say that the national election was fraudulent. What's your reaction to this latest step by the Trump administration to seize ballots in Georgia? And 6 years later, how has that turmoil from 2020 impacted voters and politics in Arizona?
Well, let's just be clear. The turmoil in 2020 was not turmoil as it pertains to the administration of the election. The 2020 election was run by regular U.S. citizens like you, me, and the viewers of this program. It's just folks who show up and do this work every couple of years whenever they're called upon, because Americans value good, solid, clean, fair, and accessible elections. So we just do that work. The turmoil was caused by those folks who were out in the parking lot of our offices at our warehouse with their long rifles, including the Q Shaman and Alex Jones and those types. That's where the turmoil came from. The folks who wanted to disrupt the election system. And let me be really clear about something. I was on that ballot in 2020 with Donald Trump, and I lost my reelection bid just like Donald Trump did in a clean election, a free and fair election. Now, since I've become Secretary of State after that, we've made sure to maintain the same kind of integrity, the same processes, for the most part, just improving some access for voters across the state. What really bothers me here is that so many Americans are just depending on somebody else to make sure that things go well. They're depending on somebody else to do the job. We as Americans individually, every single one of us, have not just the right, but the duty to stand up when things like this happen. And so when we don't have outrage, when we don't actually move that outrage into action, we're essentially complicit with what is happening. And so I'm doing everything that I can in my office to not only maintain the integrity and the lawful course of the actions of the Secretary of State, but I'm also calling on American citizens to be lawful and peaceful and assert our rights and our power. Remember, if they weren't afraid of our power, they wouldn't be trying to squelch it and keep us from using it.
Secretary Fontes, I wanted to read from the Arizona Mirror in 2020. Trump himself has repeatedly fanned the flames, alleging without evidence that Dominion machines deleted 2.7 million votes for him, and tweeting, "Now it is learned that the horrendous Dominion voting system was used in Arizona and big in Nevada. No wonder the result was a very close loss." And again, you were formerly the recorder for Maricopa County through 2021. And I wanted to go to this other issue. These two are connected. Atlantic Magazine recently published an article headlined "MAGA Thinks Maduro Will Prove Trump Won in 2020. The article quotes MyPillow founder Mike Lindell saying, quote, "I'm hoping now that Maduro will actually come clean and tell us everything about the machines and how they steal the elections," unquote. Some have speculated Trump could pardon Maduro in exchange for him stating Venezuela interfered in the 2020 election, even though no evidence of that exists. Again, that art I was reading from The Atlantic. Since you were really at the heart of it then, and Fox had to pay something like over $750 million, $750 million for libeling Dominion systems. But can you comment on all of this and the presence of this is such a complicated issue, but the presence of Tulsi Gabbard saying she was there in Georgia because she's interested in foreign interference in the elections, sort of stringing this whole thing together?
You know, I'm reminded of some of those scenes we see in sitcoms sometimes where there's a big board with a red thread that just kind of goes from here to there in conspiracy theories. But this time there's a little ketchup splattered on the wall as well. The bottom line is this. The elections in America have been free and fair since their inception. There have been minor issues here and there that get worked out through the courts. But it is in the courts, by the way, where that settlement that you mentioned happened. It is under oath and through the regular process of law and procedure that we end up with the just results. And in that case, the just results were someone was held accountable for the lies. In the world of politics, the courts will give great deference because they want politicians to be able to share ideas. And so the lies that are being spread about our elections get to go a little bit further, except when they get into the courts and when you have actual accountability. Remember, after the 2020 election, there were like 60 or 61 cases, and not a single one showed any actual evidence of wrongdoing on the part of elections officials. And being in Maricopa County, boy, let me tell you, and Maricopa, by the way, at the time, and still is, the second largest voting jurisdiction in the United States of America. We're talking about 2.5 million voters in the Metro Phoenix area. No small potatoes, and it was a tough task, but I had a great team in 2020, and we did an amazing job. So kudos to the folks on the ground. Kudos to the folks in the polling places. Kudos to everyone who knows that they can stand on their integrity, they can stand on actual history, and we can put all of the conspiracy theories aside, except that the greatest threat to American elections and our republic is the idea that Donald Trump is still lying about the 2020 election. Everything else is just a symptom of that illness, and we need to figure out a way to get past that. We, the American public, have to stand up to this president. We have to stand up to our own president, as was charged by our founders, to make sure that in our discomfort, we exercise our power and we move forward as a nation so that we can get past this and we can go back to being the folks who can innovate, who can create, who can just hang out and love one another once in a while without every single day having to worry about the grievance of the resident at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Adrian Fontes, I want to thank you for being with us. Secretary of State for Arizona, elected in 2022. Previously, he was the Maricopa County recorder who oversaw the 2020 elections. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. To look more at President Trump's calls to nationalize the elections and other attacks on the voting system, we're joined by David Becker, Executive Director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Significantly, he's a former Department of Justice attorney in the voting division. Thanks so much for being with us, David. I want to start with this picture of Tulsi Gabbard in Fulton County, which was ground zero for the 2020 election conspiracy theory, standing there on the phone. The news is that she used her cell phone for President Trump to speak on speakerphone with these FBI agents that raided the election county office and took 700 boxes of voter data and rolls away. What is the significance of the Director of National Intelligence and the President of the United States speaking with these FBI agents? How unusual is it?
It's incredibly unusual for any kind of search warrant. Usually when a search warrant is executed, it's executed by professionals who are experts in collecting evidence and establishing chain of custody. Remember, the whole purpose of a search warrant is to collect evidence for use in a future legal proceeding, probably a criminal prosecution. And to introduce that evidence, you're going to have to be able to account for that evidence every step of the way. But here you've got the Director of National Intelligence, who has no statutory authority to be involved in a domestic election investigation, and certainly not to be present during the execution of a search warrant, not only in the local county election warehouse, but apparently on the phone with the President of the United States at the time. And as disturbing as this is, I can almost assure you, it's much more disturbing to the very, very few experienced litigators who are still at the Department of Justice. Because if the Department of Justice ever sought to introduce this evidence at some point, this is a defense counsel's dream. They're going to call DNI Gabbard to the stand to establish exactly what she was doing in that building, what evidence she had access to, whether she altered the chain of custody in any way, and perhaps even call President Trump since he was on the phone during that. This is going to make that evidence really difficult to introduce at any future proceeding, which, of course, is a problem ultimately for the Department of Justice.
And can you talk about exactly, do you understand where these voter rolls went?
So my understanding is it's predominantly ballots and other documents. If it was voter rolls, it might have been printouts or something like that. I mean, those likely were old. We don't know exactly where they went. We don't know under what conditions they have been stored. We don't know what they're doing with them. And it's important also to note that the 2020 election, and Secretary Fontes made this point as well, is the most scrutinized election in world history. There has never been more litigation, more scrutiny, more review, more recounts, more audits of an election than any election in history, in world history. And those ballots in Georgia in particular, paper ballots throughout the entire state, which were recounted and recounted again, counted three times, three different ways, once entirely by hand under the observation of both parties. So we know what happened. That happened well over 5 years ago, which raises another issue because there's a federal statute of limitations about the alleged crimes that were committed that would have expired after 5 years. It's unusual that a magistrate might have signed off on this warrant. We'll have to see what happens. But my understanding is also that Fulton County has now gone to the federal district court in Atlanta to challenge this warrant. And we'll see what happens over the course of the next
now,
several days.
You were a former official at the Justice Department. This is semi-related, I think. The Wall Street Journal reported that there is a whistleblower complaint against Tulsi Gabbard so highly classified that it's said to be locked in a safe. It hasn't been shared with Congress. It was apparently filed in May. Can this have anything to do with why she's doing what she's doing?
I try to stay away from speculation on this. I don't have any specific knowledge about that whistleblower complaint. I mean, I think that, you know, she has asserted to lawmakers who challenged her on her appearance that she has authority to be there, that she's part of an overall investigation into interference in the 2020 election. It may be true. She has some authority to investigate foreign interference. Again, the statute of limitations has run. But regardless of what that complaint says, there is no valid reason for a political appointee of that level to be at any execution of a search warrant ever. You can only imagine what would have happened if the Director of National Intelligence under President Biden had been physically present at Mar-a-Lago during the execution of the search warrant when they seized documents there, and how that would have been used by his then defense counsel, Todd Blanche, who now sits as the Deputy Attorney General, to challenge the evidence in that case.
Very quickly, several of the most prominent pro-Trump election deniers are back in the news this week. You have Trump advisor Roger Stone posting a message on X reading, "Honored to chat with our incredibly effective Vice President J.D. Vance." Meanwhile, Justice Department official Ed Martin posted a photo alongside Trump's former lawyer Sidney Powell. In October 2023, she pleaded guilty in Georgia to attempting to overturn the 2020 election results. Ed Martin helped organize the Stop the Steal protests that aimed to overturn the 2020 election. And you've got the former head of the founder of Overstock, Patrick, what's his name? I think Byrne, invited back to the White House. All of them deeply involved with the conspiracy theory going to the White House on December 18th, 2020.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've got an ecosystem of grift that has grown out of the lies about the 2020 election. There are people who are targeting the sincerely disappointed supporters of President Trump. And we all understand what it means to be disappointed in an election, even if we disagree with people and how they voted. But they're being targeted by grifters to receive money over the course of this 5+ years. And it is easy to go on social media and friendly media, and even the president does this, and make false claims about the election. But as Secretary Fontes pointed out, time and time again, when they have been given the opportunity to present evidence in court over more than 5 years, time and time again, they have been begged to present evidence to defend themselves in court. And time again, in dozens of cases, including before Trump-appointed judges, in defamation cases where they could have presented the truth as a defense, Rudy Giuliani, Carrie Lake both conceded liability and defamation and accepted hundreds of millions of dollars of liability. Fox News settled the case for almost $800 million before presenting a shred of evidence. And Mike Lindell, who was sued, stood on the courthouse steps spreading lies about the election and then went inside the courthouse and said nothing, presented nothing under oath. So when you hear these lies from these grifters who continue to try to profit off of the lies about the 2020 election, ask them to tell it to a judge, because those judges have stood firm and required them to present proof. And the simple fact is the 2020 election wasn't only not a crime, it was one of the great successes of American history, not because a particular candidate won or not, but because somehow the election officials, Republicans and Democrats from the state and local level, managed an election with the highest turnout in American history during a global pandemic. And their work has withstood more scrutiny than any election in world history, and it has stood up to that scrutiny every time.
David Becker, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, former Department of Justice attorney in the Voting Decision Division. Next up, the Bulletin of Concerned Scientists have put the hands of the clock closest to midnight than they've ever been when it comes to nuclear war. Stay with us.
Sola voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correr es mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdida en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen clandestino por no llevar papel.
Performing Manu Chao's Clandestino for Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary celebration during the pandemic. And now we're moving into our 30th anniversary. I hope people come out to the historic Riverside Church on February 23rd, 7 o'clock, for an amazing celebration of 30 years of this daily global grassroots news hour. You can go to democracynow.org for tickets. Among those who will be there will be Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, the Nobel Prize-winning journalist Maria Ressa. Will also be joined by Michael Stipe, the singer and songwriter. Wynton Marsalis will be performing, as well as Hooray for the Riff Raff, and so much more. That's February 23rd. Go to democracynow.org while tickets are still there. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Arms control groups are warning the world is moving closer to nuclear war as the U.S. continues to threaten to attack Iran and a major U.S.-Russia nuclear treaty known as New START expires Thursday. Last week, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists set the doomsday clock to 85 seconds to midnight, the closest the clock's ever been to midnight in its history, due to rising threats from nuclear weapons, artificial intelligence, and the climate crisis. This is Don Hulse of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
The doomsday clock is now at 85 seconds to midnight, the closest it has been in the history of the clock. Last year, we warned that the world was perilously close to catastrophe and that countries needed to change course towards international cooperation and action on the most critical existential risks. Unfortunately, the opposite has happened. Rather than heed this warning, major countries became even more aggressive, adversarial, and nationalistic.
We're joined now by Dr. Ira Helfand, steering committee member of Back from the Brink, a national coalition which has organized people in cities and towns across the United States to call for the end of nuclear weapons. Dr. Helfand is a longtime member of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, which received the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. He's also the immediate past president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, which awarded the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. And Dr. Helfand is co-founder and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Talk about the dangers the world faces today and what this New START treaty is all about that expires tomorrow. Dr. Helfand.
Thanks for having me on, Amy.
You know, we are in a very, very dangerous moment. Things have been getting bad for some time. Tensions between the United States and Russia have been getting worse. Tensions between the United States and China have been getting worse. Tensions on the Korean Peninsula have been getting worse. India and Pakistan actually fought a war for a few days last year. It's an unprecedented situation. In the last year, five of the nine countries which have nuclear arsenals have been engaged in warfare. Russia, the United States, Israel, India, and Pakistan. And China's been making very explicit threats that they want to take over Taiwan, which would probably also involve military action. And any one of these conflicts has the potential to escalate to nuclear war. The warning that we received last week from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists really needs to be a wake-up call. We cannot afford to live in denial about this danger any longer. At one point in our history, back in the 1980s, when the danger was also very great, we all got it. You know, millions of people were marching in the streets because everybody understood how dangerous the situation was. Well, it's even more dangerous today. And the big difference is that people aren't paying attention to it. On Thursday, tomorrow, the New START Treaty is going to expire. This is the last agreement between the United States and Russia that puts limits on our nuclear arsenals. And with the expiration of this treaty, the path is now open for a very dangerous, very destabilizing arms race. We already have 1,500 nuclear warheads deployed. The Russians have the same number. The best science we have says that if these two arsenals are used in a war between the United States and Russia, 100 million people here in the United States, 100 million people in Russia, maybe another 100 million people in Europe will die in the first half hour. And the climate disruption that will result from that war will cause global famine that over the next 2 years will kill 6 billion people, excuse me, 3/4 of the human race. That same study that came up with those numbers also looked at what would happen if India and Pakistan went to war and found that a war between these two relatively small nuclear powers involving just 250 nuclear warheads could kill 100 million people directly and also lead to a global famine, not quite as severe as we'd see in a conflict between the United States and Russia, but bad enough to kill 2 billion people, a quarter of the human race in 2 years. So that's the armament we have already. And with the expiration of New START, there's talk of expanding the arsenal further. Here in the United States, there are powerful voices saying it's not enough to have 1,500 nuclear warheads. We need to have as many as the Russians and Chinese put together. Well, if the United States increases its arsenal to a size equal to the Russians and the Chinese together, the Russians are going to say they need to have an arsenal as big as the U.S. arsenal. And it's just going to cause a spiral, as we saw in the 1980s when we got to the insane level of 70,000 nuclear warheads in the world. Today it's 12,000, enough to destroy the world many, many, many times over. There is no rational reason for any country to build a single additional nuclear warhead. But with the expiration of New START, that's probably exactly what's going to happen. And that arms race is going to be dangerous, not just because of the additional numbers of weapons that are created, but also because this is a destabilizing process. It creates increased tension and leads to a greater possibility of conflict.
The New START Treaty was signed by Barack Obama and Dmitry Medvedev, Russia. Last September, right. Putin proposed each side should agree informally to stick to the warhead limits for another year. Why hasn't Trump accepted this? And ultimately, because I know you have to go, what will bring us off the brink?
I don't know why Trump hasn't accepted this. He said initially that he thought this was a good idea, but then didn't follow through on it at all. And his more recent comments have been, if it expires, no big deal. It is a big deal. It's a really terrible thing if this treaty is allowed to expire tomorrow and nothing is put in place to replace it. What we need to do at this point is to build a movement in this country that will force our leaders to take the kind of action that Gorbachev and Reagan took in the 1980s, fundamentally changing the trajectory that we're on. We have a defense policy that's based on the dangerous myth that nuclear weapons make us safe. They don't. They make us strong. But strength and safety are not the same thing. These weapons are the greatest threat to our safety, and we need to move to a world that eliminates them. We have to understand that if we don't do that, if we allow these weapons to continue to exist, it is not a question of if we have a nuclear war. It's just a question of when. We are told that there's something special about nuclear weapons. They have this magic power. It's embodied in the deterrence theory, that no one would ever use these weapons because they're so powerful. The fact is that we know of at least six occasions during the course of the nuclear weapons era when either Moscow or Washington actually began the process of launching the nuclear arsenal, only to discover at the last minute that the alarm they were responding to was a false alarm. We have not survived this far because deterrence works. We haven't survived this far because our leaders were wise all the time, because they knew what they were doing, because they had perfect information and perfect technology. We survived because, according to former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. And luck doesn't last forever. So we need a new foreign policy, a new security policy that takes this into account, that starts from the premise that our security demands that we seek a world free of nuclear weapons. It's possible we won't be able to achieve that, but we have to try, because if we don't, we know what's going to happen, and it's going to be terrible. Now, what we've done here in the United States is to build a campaign back from the brink that's designed to mobilize communities around the country around this demand that the United States begin negotiations now with the eight other countries that have nuclear weapons for a verifiable, enforceable agreement to eliminate their arsenals according to an agreed-upon timetable. We also ask the United States to take a number of unilateral steps that it can do with safely, which will lower the danger of nuclear war and demonstrate our good faith in entering into these negotiations.
Dr.
We don't ask the United States to disarm unilaterally, but to provide leadership for universal disarmament.
Dr. Ira Helfand, I want to thank you for being with us. Steering committee member of Back from the Brink National Coalition, which has organized people in cities and towns across the United States to call for the end of nuclear weapons. Speaking to us from Abu Dhabi, from the United Arab Emirates. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at that meeting between President Trump and Colombian President Gustavo Petro at the White House on Tuesday. Stay with us.
Si no peleamos por los niños, ¿qué será de nosotros?
Again, Lila Downs performing Manu Chao's Clandestino for Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary 5 years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Colombian President Gustavo Petro sat down with President Trump in a closed-door meeting that lasted approximately 2 hours at the White House Tuesday, the first face-to-face encounter between the two leaders following months of tension and heated exchanges over the Trump administration's military strikes on civilian boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific Ocean. Their talks also came a month after the U.S. attack on Venezuela and the abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife in early January. Petro's urge for Maduro's release and return to Venezuela. After the White House meeting, Petro shared a photo on social media with a note apparently handwritten by Trump that said, quote, "Gustavo, a great honor. I love Colombia," unquote, with a photograph of the two leaders shaking hands and smiling. Trump took on a drastically different tone after he previously insulted Petro, falsely accusing him of being a drug trafficker, threatening Colombia with U.S. military action. Petro spoke after the meeting on Tuesday.
I told him that between free people, one cannot act under blackmail, do this or else this happens. No, We do not act under blackmail. And I think the photos and the atmosphere of the meeting show a meeting between equals who think differently. Yes, with different powers, obviously, but capable of finding common paths. That's it. Nothing personal. He did not speak to me about his businesses, nor I about mine, which I do not have.
And this is President Trump in the Oval Office responding to questions about his meeting with Petro yesterday.
Meeting with Gustavo Petro earlier today, and did you come to any agreement on counter-narcotic efforts?
Yeah, we did. We worked on it, and we got along very well. He and I weren't exactly the best of friends, but I wasn't insulted because I never met him. I didn't know him at all. And we got along very well, and we're working on that. We're working on some other things, too, including sanctions. And but we had a very good meeting.
Colombian President Petro traveled to Washington, D.C. on a special visa after the Trump administration revoked his previous one in September when Petro joined a pro-Palestine rally outside the United Nations headquarters in New York and urged U.S. soldiers to disobey Trump. The Trump administration also issued sanctions against Petro and his family in October. For more, we go to Bogota, Colombia, where we're joined by the Colombian Senator Clara Lopez Obregón. She is a presidential candidate in the upcoming elections in Colombia scheduled for May. She was acting mayor of Bogota in 2011 and served as the Minister of Labor after that. We welcome you to Democracy Now, Senator. If you can start off by talking about what you understand took place yesterday in the Oval Office. It was a closed-door meeting. You had President Trump viciously attacking Petro. You had Petro demanding the release and return of the Venezuelan President Maduro before this meeting. And then it was all smiles afterwards. We almost thought it was a replay of President Trump meeting with the New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani.
Well, what I see is a very important repositioning of coercion and diplomacy in the Latin American context. I think President Petro was able to reframe precisely with that quote that you just passed regarding our common commitment to liberty, to freedom, from which he could establish a common language to establish very controversial issues which definitely separate us, like climate, like migration, like Venezuela, like sanctions. So I think that in a very asymmetrical position, President Petro was able to elevate through moral principles, through a force of character also, and an ethical stance, a more equal interchange with President Trump in his Oval Office, which is obviously the center of power, not only of the United States, but of the world.
What do you think, Senator Clara Lopez Obregón, is the path forward on issues like drug trafficking, energy trade, military intervention, the U.S. strikes in the Caribbean and the Pacific, and continuing to detain the Venezuelan president, not far from where we are right now, in a Brooklyn detention center, both Maduro and his wife?
Yes, this is a re-edition of the Monroe Doctrine, but not as an ideological cover for intervention in our countries, but as an instrument for coercion, depending on how good the alignment is of each country with the United States interests. Our response has to be getting together. Latin America, unfortunately, has been unable to structure a meaningful and a permanent instruments of collective action. So each country has to negotiate on its own from a position of weakness. And I think that what we have to construct in view of all of these new coercive actions and violence, international violence through military intervention and sanctions that the United States has recovered as a exercise of control, the only alternative that we have is what we call the geopolitics of the week, getting together, coordinating our diplomatic actions, and using international law in a strategic way. I think that we have to recover the moral narrative of international law with a connection with Europe, with the United States, with all the progressive sectors of society everywhere. Because what is happening in Latin America is not just Latin America's problem, as what is happening in Gaza is not just the Middle Eastern problem. They are all connected, and it has to do with the United States losing hegemony internationally with the rise of China, of India, of Russia. And I think that the only way forward has to be to resist, but also to act and create resilience through a common interest that we can discover, like energy and like migration.
Senator Clara López Obregón, we have to leave it there, but we're going to do this interview in Spanish and post online at democracynow.org/ES. Yes, Colombian Senator Clara López Obregón speaking to us from Bogota. That does it for our show. Very happy birthday to Hugh Grant. I'll be in Santa Barbara this weekend at the International Film Festival. Hope to see people there Friday and Saturday.